The more the world changes, the more we find comfort in the things that never change. Never change. This is Rabbi Daniel Lappin, on demand, on the Blaze Radio Network.
Welcome to the Rabbi Daniel Lappin Show. All you happy warriors, great to be together with you here on the only show that reveals regularly how the world really works. And one of the ways that the world really works is that we human beings have to extract from an often unwilling earth the things we need. On an individual level, that might mean finding a way to catch Pacific salmon and growing Brussels sprouts and finding a way to make a fire to cook them and to be able to eat them together. Maybe it means raising sheep and growing cotton to make clothing. And all the other more sophisticated things we need eventually, including oil and steel. Now, for countries, it's exactly the same. Countries need to be able to have access to the things they need, whether it's food or oil. Japan went to war in World War II over oil because the Japanese islands had no oil, and the British and the Americans were basically shutting off oil supplies to Japan. Well, right now, my dear friends, I think you will agree that we are all dependent on batteries. And the kind of batteries that at the moment show the most promise are called lithium-ion batteries. The problem is always one of how much electricity can you store in every unit of weight of a battery. You all know how heavy a car battery weighs, how much it weighs, and that is so. In order to be able to handle the heavy starting loads when you press the button to start your motor, it needs to be a very heavy battery. For your computer and for your telephone, you'd like a lighter battery. That's where lithium-ion batteries come in. The interesting guy, Elon Musk of Tesla, will happily tell you that he staked much of his reputation and fortune on the future of lithium-ion batteries. He even started an entire factory to make lithium-ion batteries because the entire floor of the Tesla car is essentially a huge lithium-ion battery. Now, guess what kind of substance is required to make lithium-ion batteries? By the way, iron is I-O-N, not the element I-R-O-N, with the chemical symbol Fe. No, it's lithium ion, I-O-N. So what do you think is the most important ingredient of these crucially valuable lithium ion batteries? Yes, well done. I knew that the listening demographic of this audience is extremely high level. You're exactly right. It's a substance called lithium. And where is lithium chiefly found? Well, the majority of lithium reserves in the world, lithium oxide, are found in Chile and Argentina. Now, these are two countries in South America. Chile is on the Pacific coast. Argentina is on the Atlantic coast. And between them is a huge range of mountains known as the Andes Mountains. And one of the problems that region has had in terms of economic development is transport between the two countries. Argentina would like access to Pacific Ocean ports, and Chile would like access to Atlantic Ocean ports and the Argentinian market. At the moment, there is a road. It's virtually impossible in winter. It's very slow and very difficult and very challenging the rest of the year because it climbs up over the Andes and goes down the other sides. It's very tough. Well, great news. A tunnel is being built through the Andes. It is a huge engineering project. Huge. Tunneling through the base of the Andes to end up with what is essentially a horizontal highway between Argentina and Chile. It's going to be incredible. This is a time, as this goes forward, it's a time to be thinking about investing in those two countries. It's phenomenal. A great project. Guess who's going to be building the project? You won't be horrified to hear that it's China is going to be the contracting. Now, when I say China, I don't just mean a Chinese contracting company like the China Tunneling Corporation or the China Road and Bridge Corporation. No, it's essentially the Chinese government, as all those entities are essentially arms of the Chinese government. Do you think there could be any risk to America's access to lithium if China ends up controlling Argentinian and Chilean lithium exports, which I confidently predict they will? I think the Chinese strategy is absolutely brilliant. And what I'm going to be talking about on this show is showing you how that works. But first of all, let's go back to somewhere where we can already see how Chinese strategies have worked, and that is Africa. We're going to take a journey to the east coast of Africa and to the country called Kenya and to its only harbor called Mombasa. In 1956, the Columbia Corporation put out a movie called Beyond Mombasa. It starred Cornel Wilde and also Donna Reed. And it had in it a British actor called Leo Genn. It was Genn, G-E-N-N. I don't know how that's pronounced. But Leo Genn played the role of Ralph Hoyt, a missionary. Okay, the movie is set in Africa, and we're talking about the 1950s. So as you can imagine, viewed with today's sensibilities, I have no doubt that the movie would be dismissed as hideously racist, because the depiction of the indigenous Africans in Kenya, which is where this was British Kenya still in those days. Kenya didn't achieve its independence till about 10 years later or a bit more. But at the time, it was British Kenya. It was a big outpost of British expats. A lot of British folks, even high society people, who for one reason or another were not doing well, things had gone wrong with their lives, they moved to Kenya. And there was a very lively community of British expats living in Kenya during this period. Kenya was an important British colony, and the British really did build the country up. So the movie then depicts the story of white people coming to Kenya, and they find a mine, whatever it is. Bottom line is that Leo Genn plays Ralph Hoyt, a missionary. And the movie came across my radar screen and was of interest only because Ralph Hoyt, the missionary, and spoiler alert, okay, any of you intending to watch Beyond Mombasa, 1956 by the Columbia movies, don't do it. It's really not worth it. But if you did, you'd discover that completely unexpectedly, there were no clues, and I think you sort of end up feeling that they didn't play fair with you, because you'd never have been able to figure out the bad guy is actually the missionary. And it's interesting to me because pretty much I always say about early 1960s, pretty much until that time, the Catholic character, the Christian character, was always depicted as wholesome, moral, decent, upright, all-round good person. And it really wasn't until the 1960s that we began to see the priest depicted as the bad guy, the pastor depicted as the bad guy. But until that time, it was always good. And that was sort of one of the huge changes that came about in movies. And I think The Sound of Music might have been the last time where we saw a decent and upright portrayal, in this case, the Mother Superior of the convent that Julie Andrews was at, comes across as wise and compassionate, just a really outstanding human being. But a few years earlier, Beyond Mombasa, missionary Ralph Hoyt turns out to be absolutely insane, and he's killing people altogether. Okay, fine. What's interesting, however, of course, is that to me, Mombasa, the port city of Kenya, is down obviously at sea level, and it's always been an important harbor. Interestingly enough, because there was from the earliest times, there was travel between Israel and the whole east coast of Africa. It was mostly Arab traders. There was a lot of slavery going on and a lot of trading in general. But a lot of the names of places up that trading route were of Hebrew origin, because originally that route between Israel, the tip of Israel in the Red Sea and all the way down the coast, was very, very well traveled. And so, for instance, going on your journey up the coast of East Africa towards Israel, you would pass Somalia on your left and you would pass Yemen on your right. Well, not surprisingly, those two nations were named left and right. In Hebrew, Somal is left in Hebrew, Yemen is right in Hebrew, and so Somalia and Yemen were respectively left-hand side and right-hand side of your course as the waterway narrowed and you began to approach Israel. Mombasa is a contraction of the two words water, land, Maim Yabasha. In Hebrew, the SH sound is the same as the S sound, and water is the double M sound. Water, land, why? Well, if you fly over the Mombasa region, you will see that it's just this huge area of water and land. It's islands and inlets and waterways and bays rivers and all kinds of things. Anyway, if there ever was a place that deserved the sobriquet of water land, that would be Mombasa. And there it is, big bustling port, very old, old city. There's an Arab, there's a very strong Arab a component to the city and the neighboring areas. And there it is down at sea level. Meanwhile, the main population of Kenya, the main city of Kenya is Nairobi, is up on the plateau, much, much higher than Mombasa, and quite far inland. When I say quite far, I'm going to say 700 or 800 miles, something like that. It's a long time. I took a motorcycle through Africa as a lark when I was 22. But, and so I'm just going on memory. I haven't looked it up. But from Mombasa to Nairobi, it's got to be like 700, 800, 900 miles, something like that. It's a good long distance. And there's also an elevation gain. And meanwhile, the center of British administration of the country was Nairobi. And that was really the city. And even today, outside of South Africa, Nairobi is it remains a very bustling, big city, having vastly outgrown its original size. But there it is. I think perhaps, and I may be wrong, but Princess Elizabeth, was she in Nairobi when she heard that her father had died? I'm not sure about that. At any rate, I'm just making the point that Nairobi is a significant city. Well, the British had a problem, and that is that everything that arrived in Kenya from the homeland, from the United Kingdom, had to come by ship, obviously. And how do you get the stuff from the coastal port of Mombasa up to Nairobi? So they built a railroad. The British built this railroad. It was a huge undertaking. I mean, it was built in 1900, yeah, I think from like 1896 to 1903, something like that, round about 1900. It took 5-6 years. They brought in workers from another part of the British Empire, from India, tens of thousands of workers. And at the end of the job, about 5 or 10,000 of the workers decided not to go back to India, and they stayed in Kenya. That became the foundation of the very large Indian population of East Africa. And it wasn't until Kenyan independence, and in Uganda, a little bit to the north, was Idi Amin and his brutality that eventually chased them out. But the Indians did a huge amount for commerce and trade in East Africa, earning themselves, as you can imagine, much hatred and jealousy. But meanwhile, the railroad was built, and with typical British eccentricity, they built it on a non-standard gauge. They built it on like 39 inches. They built it in exactly a 1 meter wide gauge, and it did the trick, so much so that there were a number of major ferry boats. Big ships were running on Lake Victoria. How did they get there? Well, the boats were built in Scotland, disassembled, packed into huge crates, and sent by ship to Mombasa, transferred to this railway, brought up to Nairobi, and then a little bit further, the railway extended to the shores of Lake Victoria. They were taken off and reassembled. And these are like 2,000-ton vessels, big, big, big boats. And they constituted the very first ferry boats that served Lake Victoria in the heart of Africa. Meanwhile, the British ran the country and built it and developed it. And again, some people on the side that decided to demonize colonialism as this horrible, dreadful evil, speak of it as a bad time. My own experience, I obviously wasn't there during the colonial period, but when I have been in Nairobi, I've spoken to people just talking to citizens, and it's been many years. I've not been there for decades. But when I was last there, I'd run into people who spoke very nostalgically about the time the British were there. And what they said was the post office worked, the trains worked, the hospitals worked, you could get medicine. Yes, there was no independence, right? It was a British colony. For the ordinary Joe in the street, they didn't really care about whose colony it was. They knew that if it became independent, life would deteriorate for them, and that's exactly what happened. There were a few Africans at the top of the heap. Kenneth Kaunda was one of them, and there were a number of others who had received an education in Britain, and they knew how to work the governmental game, and they emerged as the kings and rulers of Kenya, in many ways far less benevolent than the British had been while they were there. That's just another view of the colonial period that you're unlikely to hear on any American university campus. Anyway, the reason I tell you all of that is to tell you that there is a vast Chinese company, and like all companies in China, or most of them, basically an arm of the Chinese Communist government, and it's called the China Road and Bridge Corporation. If it is not the largest engineering firm in the world, it's pretty close to that. And the list of the huge bridges, roads, and railways that they have constructed, would fill a small file folder. It's a huge company. Anyways, turns out that they've got an interesting strategy they use. And those of you who've been listening for a few years will know that during the time of the 2016 election period, not only was I an enthusiastic supporter of Trump, but I also repeatedly emphasized that I did not feel that Russia was the big enemy. And after the election was over, I believed then, and I continue to believe now, that the entire legend of Russian involvement in our election was something that was created by Camp Clinton on the morning of November 9th, when they knew they had to scramble in order to come up with an explanation for why Hillary lost. I do believe that, and if the show was about that, I would tell you the many reasons I have for believing that. However, I did emphasize then that I saw absolutely no reason for us to demonize Russia. I don't believe America's business is to measure the morality of other nations. Our business is to act in the interests of the United States of America. If Saudi Arabia murders its own journalist, and it didn't happen on American territory, my position is it's none of our business. It's not our job to turn the whole world into Judeo-Christian, Western civilization, morality-adhering people. It would be nice if that happened, but I'm not willing to take hard-earned money from American taxpayers in order to bring about these utopian dreams that were a part of why we went to war in Iraq. Oh, we're going to bring democracy to Iraq. All of this was nonsense, and the notion that we must punish Saudi Arabia because they murdered their own journalist. Look, if you're going to take that position, then there are literally very few countries in the world you should talk to. You're going to talk to Turkey after the genocide they perpetrated against the Armenians in the first part of the 20th century. You're going to talk to Rwanda after what the Hutus did to the Tutsis. You're going to talk to the folks in the Sudan. And not only that, but all the other instances of assassinations and murders perpetrated by virtually all the countries. The idea of descending on Saudi Arabia, I believe, was primarily intended to embarrass President Trump more than anything else. I think he's taken exactly the right track, that we do not spend money on trying to civilize other nations other than what is necessary for our own security. But in this case, yeah, I just don't think that that played any role whatsoever. So no reason to demonize Russia. I felt there was every reason to form an alliance with Russia. If Russia could keep their seaport in Syria, that's really pretty much all they care about in the Middle East situation. President Obama was plain dead, dishonest, and wrong. I mean, everything he touched in that area, the so-called Arab Spring, Libya and Gaddafi, the Assad situation, almost everything the man touched was a calamity because he did have no overall concept at all of what America's relationship is to other countries, and for a variety of other reasons as well, I should tell you. But for the moment, at any rate, China. Now, there, I've always felt, is a very, very serious problem. And ignoring it and myopically focusing on Russia is something for which I think the country in the future, another generation perhaps, will have to pay the price. God help us. I hope it's not a bad one. But the expansionism, the aggression, all of the dangerous tendencies that were constantly being ascribed to Putin and Russia, illusion. But where it's really happening is China. Now, I think everybody knows that one of the areas of enormous concern to me, but it should be to everybody, is valuable mineral availability. There are special minerals, including lithium, by the way, and I don't have to tell you the role that lithium plays in electronics today. All you have to do is take a look at the specifications on your phone, and you will discover how valuable lithium is. China has been closing in on monopolizing basically the world's supply of lithium, plus a whole other supply of crucial metals. There are metals that have to do with very strong magnets. China is monopolizing successfully the availability of all those things as well. Okay, what has this got to do with Mombasa and Africa? I'll tell you that in just a moment. But first of all, I want to make sure that I don't neglect the commercial side of things, whereby I bring you things of value to you and you pay money to me. That's the way it works. This way, we both emerge happier from the transaction, and I am thereby motivated to continue producing more and more resources that can improve the quality of your life. The resource I draw your attention to in this instance is called Madam, I'm Adam, Decoding Marriage Secrets from Eden. Please take a look at them at the website. Go to RabbiDanielLappin.com, www.RabbiDanielLappin.com, and go to the store section, have a look and read up about Madam, I'm Adam, Decoding the Marriage Secrets from Eden, and see if this is something that you and your beloved need to listen to, or whether people in your orbit, friends or family, who are either about to get into a dating and matrimonial relationship or need help, anybody should be able to benefit from that program. Madam, I'm Adam, Decoding Marriage Secrets from Eden. RabbiDanielLappin.com is the place to go. And at the same time, while you're there, make sure you're receiving our weekly emails. Check out Thought Tools, Susan's Musings. You'll love the most recent Ask the Rabbi, by the way. This is about a guy who divorced 10 years ago, remarried 8 years ago, and is now obsessively focused on communicating with his former first wife. And he wants to write to her. He asks whether that's a good idea. And in our response to him, we came down so heavily on him that several of the comments, which you can read there at RabbiDanielLappin.com, took issue with us. And one woman in particular said, you know, men have feelings as well. You shouldn't have told him to act like a man. Well, we did tell him to act like a man. Why we did that, you'll be able to read over there at RabbiDanielLappin.com. So, how does your rabbi believe that China is executing a 21st century model of colonization? And to whatever extent Britain, Portugal, Germany, Belgium, Italy managed to benefit and gain from the colonies they raised and developed elsewhere in the world, well, to that extent, China is doing the same thing. It's a brilliant strategy. How does it work? Well, I may be a little bit ahead of the curve in suggesting this as a deliberate strategy, but I think it is. And I think that if you keep your eyes open for this kind of trend over the next few years, I think you will see that you were forewarned of what exactly is going on. Let me tell you, first of all, what happened in Zambia. China, through the well-known China Road Bridge Corporation, came to Zambia and they said, hey, you guys, you know, you are owners of the world's largest copper reserves. I know you don't have money, you don't have Chinese currency, you don't have American currency, but you guys don't have a proper airport. Your airport is a mess. It's ancient. It doesn't work. You need a new international airport. And secondly, while you have this beautiful dam called the Kariba Dam, and it is a huge potential hydroelectric project, it's been neglected since it was built back in the 1960s. It's been neglected. Silt and mud have accumulated. Most of the generators are not running. Tell you what, we, the China Bridge, Road and Bridge Corporation. We will come in, we'll build you an airport, we'll build you, we'll fix up your electricity generation, and we will build you out an electric grid around the whole country. And you will pay us back with copper. That's all. And that's how China secured its supply of copper. But they wrote in quite stringent repayment terms in the contract. All this that I'm telling you now is, this part is all fact. My conjecture extends only to the observation that this is a deliberate strategy. I am aware of it playing out in two countries. It may be others. I have not researched the other countries yet, but I will leave that for the interested among you to pursue and report back to me so I can notify everybody. So what happens? They write very stringent contracts with Zambia, and repayment terms and times are very specific. And the penalty is the surrender of the very facilities that the Chinese Road and Bridge Corporation built in the first place. Also built into the contract was that any arbitration or legal disputes have to be resolved in China under Chinese law. Well, I think you see where this is going. Well, not surprisingly, because of the terms of the contract and the loan to build this infrastructure, there was absolutely no way Zambia was going to be able to keep to the terms of the repayment. And they didn't. They defaulted. And so even as I'm speaking to you, the International Airport of Zambia is passing into Chinese control. And the electrical grid, the whole electrical system of Zambia, yeah, that's right, you got it, passing into Chinese control. A great deal of the valuable material, such as copper and other metals needed by China, are available in Zambia. China is doing brilliantly. Now let's go back to Kenya, Mombasa. Well, the port in Mombasa has enormous potential, but it's run down. It's old. It's more than 100 years old, and it looks it. It also functions that way. And meanwhile, the old narrow gauge railway between Mombasa and Nairobi was completely inappropriate for 20th century conditions, late 20th century conditions. Impossible. Well, once again, our friendly Chinese, in the form of the China Road and Bridge Corporation, stopped in at Kenya and they said, hey, you guys, we'll do your port. We'll totally rebuild your harbor so it can handle anything and everything. And the Kenyans said, well, a fat lot of good that'll do us. The goods will pile up on the dock because we have no way of getting them to the main industrial and commercial part of the country in the highlands, namely the areas around Nairobi. And the Chinese said, ah, you mean because of that 100-year-old British-built narrow-gauge railway? And they said, yeah, that's the problem. China Road and Bridge Corporation said, no problem at all. We'll build you a brand new, spanking, efficient, standard gauge railway from Mombasa to Nairobi. And the Kenyans said, really? And they said, sure. And once again, they set up a contract that would be adjudicated or arbitrated in China, under Chinese law, and they again set terms that simply were not going to be paid. The Kenyans said, well, you know, when we're going to make money on cargo fees on the railway, and we're going to make money on ships using the port, we'll be able to pay the Chinese for all their work. Well, as it turns out, that was not to be. And so at the time of my recording this show, China is in the process of acquiring the port of Mombasa and acquiring the standard gauge railroad from Mombasa to Nairobi. Once again, Kenya is home to many natural resources, and once again, China is brilliantly looking to the future, while America bleats about democracy and human rights violations. China is building for a dominant 21st century. America, not so much. Let me tell you something else about Africa, if I may. I was born there and I grew up there until my parents sent me away to school in England for good and sufficient reason, I can tell you, because I was turning into a barefoot savage. And then after that, I did go back and spent a few years in South Africa before I left for the United States. During that time, I got a chance to see a few things. Now, I will tell you, I've not been back since I immigrated to the United States of America. I have not been back to Africa at all. However, all indications are that, God willing, this is likely to change. I have become an enormous enthusiast of things that are happening in much of Africa at the moment. I'm very hopeful. And to put it bluntly, I think Africa is moving in the right direction, while America is moving in the wrong direction. What do I mean? Well, I'll explain that more fully. But for now, let it be said that back then, while I was still in Africa, there were certain characteristics that identified the continent as part of the Third World, if not the very capital of the Third World. What were these characteristics? Well, a poorly functioning economy, corruption, a lot of poverty, no clean water to drink. I mean, notoriously, in many parts of Africa, villagers particularly had to walk miles to get fresh water, and even then it wasn't pasteurized or clean. One of the parasites found in water in South Africa is called bilharzia, which is a frightful and horrible thing, and people in Africa were suffering from that. The main form of transport in Africa was bicycles. Corruption was widespread. People lived in the way that homeless people in America live. They lived in shanty towns. The continent was rife with tribalism. This group of people were in one tribe, that group of people were in another tribe. This tribe didn't like that tribe. This tribe was trying to get benefits at the expense of that tribe. This tribe was crying victim. Another sign of Africa being the Third World was the state of public hygiene. I mean, you could walk around, even in cities, and there would be human excrement all over the place, let alone animal excrement. It was filthy, absolutely filthy. And finally, there was uncontrolled and unrestrained prosecutorial malice. It was a sign of the Third World that if you got on the wrong side of anybody powerful in Africa, the next thing would happen is you would be prosecuted for something. And it was completely irrelevant as to whether you'd actually done anything wrong or not, because you would be utterly ruined by the lengthy and hopeless, futile prospect of defending yourself. And as soon as you made progress in one area, the prosecution would just throw another charge at you on top of the one before. My friends, a lot of these things have improved in Africa, but I'll tell you where they are deteriorating, and you will be shocked to hear. There's one place in the world where all of these things, which I highlighted as the conspicuous marks of third worldism in Africa, well, they're all improving. But there's one place that's getting a whole lot worse on every one of these metrics. And I'll tell you about it. But first of all, again, and you probably know this by now, I'm not trying to irritate you. I know many of you are saying, oh, I know what he's going to say now, www.rabbidaniellappin.com. But I am still surprised that every now and then I get comments or letters from people who listen to this show and have no idea of my website. They ask me information which is available on the website. This happens on Facebook, it happens on Twitter, it happens on YouTube, and it's, I don't get it. How is it possible that you listen to this show and you do not know that my website is www.rabbidaniellappin.com? How can you not know that? At any rate, the resource I draw your attention to today is a two-hour audio program with study guide on male-female relationships. It's called Madam, I'm Adam, Decoding Marriage Secrets from Eden. And it's a must-hear for anybody who wants to be in a good relationship with somebody of the opposite gender. And anybody who wants to be in a better relationship, you definitely need to hear this. At any rate, at the very least, you should read more about it. And you will find that for a very reasonable investment, this program can become yours and available to those in your orbit of influence. It's called Madam, I'm Adam, Decoding Marriage Secrets from Eden. And the website is rabbidaniellappin.com. By the way, the website has on it frequently asked questions, FAQs. And I constantly am asked these questions by people listening to the show. My dear friends, I love hearing from you. I even answer many of you. But when you ask me a question that is answered on my website, I will not answer. It's unreasonable. I'm very busy, as I know you are too. Let's not waste each other's time. If you want to know the answer to many of your standard questions, just go to the website, rabbidaniellappin.com. Okay? All right, let's proceed as I delve more deeply into where the real third world is today. Okay, onwards we go, you noble and happy warriors. It was back in 1979 that the talented movie maker Francis Ford Coppola did a movie called Apocalypse Now. I've never seen it. I can't tell you a whole lot about it, other than the fact that it was based on a novel by a wonderful English writer called Joseph Conrad. Now, when I say he's an English novelist, that is true, but he was actually a Pole. His native language was Polish, and he came to England, not only learned to speak English, but learned to write in English, and wrote some fantastic books. One of them, which is just amazingly readable. And again, I'm cautious about recommending books because there are many great books that are not suitable for everybody. And there are many other books that may not rank up there as great novels in my view, but would make wonderful reading for many people. So at any rate, my view is to be aware of Joseph Conrad. I found his book, Almayer's Folly, to be one of the most poignant and difficult to read books emotionally that I can ever remember reading. About a guy who had dreams for his daughter. And he was an expat from Europe living in some isolated place, hoping to make his fortune. Anyway, that was Almayer's Folly. But Joseph Conrad wrote a book called Heart of Darkness. And as I say, that became the basis of Francis Ford Coppola's movie Apocalypse Now. Heart of Darkness was written about 1900, just about the turn of the century. As it turns out, 80 years before Francis Ford Coppola made it into a movie. Heart of Darkness is set in the Congo, right? That huge part of Central Africa. And it was partially Belgium, it was partially French. It was European colonial. Now, I'll tell you a general rule, and that is that England left its colonies in far, far better condition than Germany, Italy, Portugal, France, and Belgium did. The Congo was a mess. I mean, compared to Nigeria, compared to Ghana, compared to Kenya, it was a complete mess. I'm somewhat into Africa, and I'm very much hoping to be going to speak there this year in a number of countries, and I look forward to it very much. One of the reasons I look forward to it is because Africa, my friends, is moving in the right direction, and the Congo, while not the same as Kenya or Ghana or even Nigeria, the Congo is also struggling. It went through all kinds of turbulence in the early 60s when it broke away from the European colonial powers. And it ended up eventually, and I'm not going to spend time on this, but it ended up, the northern section ended up the Republic of the Congo. And its main city is Kinshasa, and is Brazzaville. And it has a port on the Atlantic Ocean. The southeastern portion became the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Very easy to confuse the two. They are separated by the Congo River, which is a huge river and navigable for a long, long way. And in fact, for a long time, most of the transport in the Congo was by water. There were canals and rivers and tributaries and waterways, everything built, and lakes, huge lakes, everything existing around this huge river called the Congo River. And Heart of Darkness is about a guy in the Congo, and anyway, his name is Kurtz, and it's he has a trading post in the Congo. You know, for anybody interested in good writing, and for anybody interested in Africa, it's fascinating. Anyways, why am I telling you all this? Because the southeastern portion, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, again on the other bank of the Congo River, just had elections. And here's the good thing. Was there cheating and was there dishonesty in the elections? No question about it. However, everybody's admitting that. And everybody's committed to repairing it. And guess who is the most respected institution in the Democratic Republic of the Congo? The Catholic Church. That's right. And the Catholic Church is looked to fix up the election process and to declare the winner. And the Catholic Church is accepting that task and that obligation. It's very hopeful because I know another country which in 2016 in November had elections with enormous dishonesty, a huge amount of cheating, a lot of fraudulent voting, and nobody's talking about it. Nobody's trying to fix it. Nobody's acknowledging that it happened. So I ask you, which is the third world country and which is the country moving in the right direction, moving towards the first world? I think it's pretty clear that the Democratic Republic of the Congo is heading towards the first world status, and the United States of America at the moment, you know, is pointed in the third world direction. Looking at elections as a metric. Now, I was in the Congo in the very early 1960s. The problems had already begun, and the reason I was there was I was being sent to Bible school in Israel by my parents, and I was flying on South African Airways, a DC-7, if you must know, which is a four-engine propeller plane. Very noisy, vibration, bumpy, and lengthy, slow. Anyways, it couldn't do the whole journey from South Africa to Israel nonstop, and so we stopped in the Belgian Congo, in the Congo, and I believe we stopped in, I think it was, I'm really sorry, I can't remember, it was Brazzaville, which is today the Republic of the Congo, whether we stopped in Kinshasa, I don't quite remember, but it was one of those places. I'll tell you two things I remember very clearly. I mean, I was pretty young. Two things I remember very clearly. One of them was that there were a lot of guys with big guns around. There were machine guns, a lot of soldiers with machine guns. Number two, I remember seeing people using the main arrival area, this big, beautiful lobby that had been built by the Belgians, and they were using it as a public toilet. So when we got off the plane to go and sit inside the lounge while they refueled the plane, we were shepherded by extremely hostile-looking guys with big guns, and we sat in a room in which people were relieving themselves in every way, in every place. I've never forgotten that. And that is because Africa used to be a third world place. Now, I will tell you, talking again about the China Road and Bridge Corporation, they've also just finished a huge project, a massive road and the longest bridge in this part of Africa. I don't even know where in Africa there might be a longer bridge, to tell you the truth. But it's a bridge, the Brazzaville Viaduct, and again, the China Road and Bridge Corporation built this for the Republic of the Congo. And are they going to be taking that over as well? At the moment, I'm not hearing that, but obviously, I would not be surprised. Because once again, it seems the China Road and Bridge Corporation's model is to make magnanimous offers with loans of the money to cover the construction, and then in due course to take over the assets, either the constructed assets or others. In the case of the Republic of the Congo, I dare say what the Chinese would like to take over are various mineral resources and mines. Many of the minerals that China needs and wants are found in the Congo, and it's very likely that China completely and brilliantly defeats the United States in the race for African resources. Whether it's Kenya or Zambia or Republic of the Congo or many other places, by the way, that I could tell you about, China is well ensconced. The local governments are indebted to China, and whatever happens, China's supply of strategic minerals is very, very safe indeed. The same, unfortunately, cannot be said for us. I'm afraid the locusts ate the years, the Obama years, the George W. Bush years. Yeah, the locusts ate those years, and I look in hope to President Trump to see the reality of these things. Like I told you, from May 2016 all the way to the elections, I told you, you know, I'm not addressing his character. I'm not addressing his morality. All I'm addressing is the fact that he will operate as the chief executive with the idea of how an astute businessman would do things. And that's all one could hope for. And I think that is precisely how he has delivered. At any rate, that is indeed where things stood with the Congo. And the interesting thing, as I say, is that back then, when I was there in 61, I believe it was, and it was filthy, and there were no elections, and people who various dictators arose to subjugate the country after the colonial powers left, leaving the locals far, far worse off than they had ever been under Belgium or French rule. But off they went. The tyrants and the dictators arose. Filth spread. Elections were unknown. There was no transport. There was no housing. There was tribalism. It was the third world. There's no question about it. But now, when you visit the countries I've spoken about, Ghana, Nigeria, the Christian part of Nigeria, the Islamic part of Nigeria remains very problematic. Both Congos, Kenya, Zimbabwe is a huge problem. Zambia and South Africa looks as if it could still be a huge problem, so the jury is still out. But looking at these countries, it's amazing because they're clean. They have motor cars. Today, the population is not all dependent on bikes anymore. The corruption is certainly there, but it's acknowledged and being grappled with. They're dealing with it. Cities are being built. Roads are being built. There's infrastructure. Public hygiene is a reality. And some measure of the freedoms of Western democracy are becoming widely known. In a place like Ghana, it's extensive. So it's worth bearing in mind that all of these countries I've been talking about, plus many more I'm not addressing, are moving in the right direction. They are going from what used to be third world status towards first world status. They're doing all the things you're supposed to be doing in order to create a first world nation. They're moving in the right direction. I can't wait to go back. I haven't been back to Africa for decades and decades. So I'm very much looking forward to working out the details of being able to visit the continent this coming year, as I said. But how's about the United States of America? Are we also continuing to move in the right direction? I think not. What do you mean? Well, I think that America is moving in the direction from a one-time first world nation towards third world status. What? The United States of America, third world status? What are you talking about? Hey, don't rely on me. I'm only your rabbi. You can rely on the New York Times, which a few years ago actually had an article identifying Los Angeles as one of the largest cities of the third world. That's right. I'll explain what I mean. But first of all, one more reminder that you want to go to our website, rabbidaniellappin.com. Yes, you might want to read the frequently asked questions so that you don't have to write to ask me these things. You might want to read some of the last episodes of Thought Tools or Susan's Musings or Ask the Rabbi, which is really a lot of fun. And you might want to also take a look, read up about a two-hour audio study program called Madam, I'm Adam, Decoding Marriage Secrets from Eden. Look, there are two children's stories that are told out there, right? There's Aladdin and there's Cinderella. In Cinderella, the common lowly born girl marries the prince and becomes the queen. In Aladdin, the common lowly born boy marries the princess. Which one is more realistic? Which one do we find happening more often in real life? Well, one way of looking at it is that, the business executive traveling first class, often, I know so many of these stories from both sides, often used to end up marrying a beautiful airline stewardess he met on a flight. It did happen back in the days when airline stewardesses were all beautiful. on American domestic carriers. By the way, in an older episode, you remember a few months ago I did an episode entitled Men Do Not Propose to Her Until You Listen to This Show. And I spoke a lot about one of the things I mentioned was this very point, and I spoke about a beautiful stewardesses, and somebody listening to the show, you know, and you can listen to the show on a lot of different platforms. Somebody listening on YouTube actually wrote a comment, which I haven't responded to yet, but I will, saying how disappointed and saddened she was to hear me as a married man speak about beautiful stewardesses. So I don't actually know if she was bothered that I noticed, or bothered that I acknowledged it, or bothered that I thought they were beautiful, but whatever it is, I love hearing from people, and I love the opportunity to correct misapprehensions such as that one. But at any rate, if you've ever wondered why it is that, yes, successful upper-end businessmen often married penniless stewardesses working on their flight. It used to happen. How often do you think it used to happen? And admittedly, there were fewer female executives, but they existed. How often do you think a wealthy female single traveling on an airplane ended up dating her male steward? It doesn't happen. Princesses do not marry peasants. But princes often marry peasant girls. Why? Well, I thought you'd probably want to know, and in Madam, Decoding Marriage Secrets from Eden, you will hear the clue to that conundrum, as well as many, many others. So don't hesitate. Head over to www.rabbidaniellappin.com. Okay? Go on. You know you want to. All right, fine. Maybe you don't, but you know I want you to. So now it falls upon your rabbi, not only the burden of being a sane man in a demented age, but also the burden, the sad burden, of explaining why it is that while most of Africa is on track moving from the first world to, from the third world to the first world, to modern development status, America, the United States of America, is sadly moving from first world status to third world status. How do I say that? Why do I say that? Well, let's revisit the metrics that I've alluded to, those things which enable the visitor to a country to quickly determine whether they are in a third world country or a first world country. In no particular order, let's take a look at the first. The first one is water. Now, when you want to take a shower in Africa, in most places in Africa, you go into a nice hotel and you take a shower, you get as much water as you want. Huge volumes of hot water cascade over you. My goodness, you can even have that happen in little countries like Switzerland or Liechtenstein in Europe. But in America, now in America, we all have low flow nozzles. You go into an American hotel. Even hotels that I don't patronize, like, you know, I'm not an enthusiast of the Ritz-Carlton, but it's obviously a very fine hotel chain. I just find it bothersome to have people hovering all the time, asking you, if they can do things for you or direct your place. It's just too much. But on the one or two occasions where I have been housed there by organizations for whom I've been speaking, I must tell you, I know how much they paid for my room, and it's not worth it. You want to take a shower, and the water dribbles out. It's a low-flow nozzle. right? Because there's a water shortage, especially in California. Everybody knows that. You flush a toilet in an American hotel, and very often you need to flush two or three times. You'll pardon me. But that's just because it's low-flow toilets. When you want to flush a toilet, anywhere in the world that I've been lately, Israel, Switzerland, Great Britain, you flush, it flushes, it's not a problem. America has a water problem. It shouldn't, but it does. Now, you'll remember that there was a time when ministries around the world, James Robeson's Life Today and many other ministries, raised money to build water supplies for African villages. And it's very commendable, it's very beautiful, it's very lovely. But I really want to suggest that some of these ministries now start trying to solve America's water problem, because we're becoming a third world nation. It's like water is a major issue. It's absurd. It shouldn't be. But a socialist-leaning government has created shortage where none needs to exist. Bottom line, looking at the result is that you want water, America's moving towards the third world. Looking at our water situation, hello, third world, here we come. By the way, I mentioned the New York Times running an article on Los Angeles of the third world, and they did, in fact. The article was entitled How Los Angeles is Becoming a Third World City, published in July 2015. And it was written by, I think, an immigrant from Guatemala, and a guy called Hector Tobar. But at any rate, he makes the case very persuasively that now, when you go to Los Angeles, it's very possible that you hang out at the beach and at Disneyland and Universal Studios and Beverly Hills, and you say, what is Rabbi Daniel Lappin talking about? This is a modern, up-to-date city with everything you could possibly want. Have you been to Rodeo Drive? Yeah, look, Los Angeles is a big place. And you probably may not even be aware that there's a whole section of Los Angeles called Little Bangladesh. And you may not be aware that, and again, I don't know that these numbers are reliable, but the United States Census listed over 25,000 homeless people in the city living in tents and living in shacks and shanty towns and under tarpaulins and so on. And they look just like small villages in Africa used to look in the 1960s. And you got to be aware that's what it's like. And that's another distinction between the first world and the third world. The first world has housing. The third world has lots and lots of people living in shanty towns. Under its new leadership, even Brazil is cleaning up that part of it and moving back towards the first world. But in the United States of America, we not only tolerate homeless encampments, but we accommodate to them and we raise money to help them. Look, I'm not going to take the time now to discuss homelessness. Suffice it to say that in a country where in almost any state of the union, anybody can apply for and get with minimal obstacles, very few hoops to jump through, you can get a lot of money for free from your fellow citizens. In welfare payments, in food stamps, in Section 8 housing, all free cell phones, all kinds of things you can get. There is absolutely no reason for anybody to be homeless other than by choice. Well, we're tolerating it. We're allowing the emergence of an entire demographic, a whole, and I'm going to, apropos of this whole conversation, I'm going to call it a tribe, a whole tribe of the homeless, which enables an entire bureaucracy to grow to serve that particular tribe. Every single sign of third worldism in the United States of America. Here's another one. Cities like Seattle and New York and San Francisco, a number of other cities, particularly democratically controlled left-leaning cities, played havoc with traffic by creating bike lanes. It's now being recognized to be a disaster. Seattle has publicly acknowledged that the number of people who ride bicycles, who commute bikes to work, has dropped continuously since they began building bike lanes on all the major highways. And it's now insignificant. A trivial number of people bike, and the number of accidents involving cars and bikes has risen to unacceptable levels. And basically, they're getting ready to call it quits. New York wrecked traffic through Midtown because of bike lanes. Again, a disaster. San Francisco, a disaster. For years and years and years, the left has been pushing bikes. And so while Africa has been working to get people out of bicycles into cars, America has been working on getting people out of cars and into bicycles. How dumb do you have to be? I mean, you really are going to tell me that I'm going to put on a suit or clean clothing in the morning to go to work, and then I'm going to ride a bicycle to work. And I'm going to need to take a shower when I get to work. My clothing is going to be messed up, even if it doesn't rain. There are puddles. Cars go by and throw up dirt. And I arrive at work in a mess, and I'm hot and tired. I'm really going to do that? Yeah, while it was a novel idea for a little while, very cool, cutting-edge people, of which I'm not one, thought, oh, yeah, we got to do this. Yeah, this is a really good idea. Let's ride a bike to work. Had they listened to their rabbi, they would have heard that that was a really dumb idea. Bikes should be used for recreation, not for main transport. Anybody who's trying to leave the third world knows that. But America is moving back towards the third world. And so bikes are still being pushed at by mayors of progressive cities around the country. Bicycles are the way to go. No, they really aren't. Cars are the way to go. And your job in government is to make sure that traffic flows, not to do what you have been doing. This is well known, by the way, causing such an awful mess of traffic flow so as to force people into light rail, bicycles, and buses. Corruption. All right. Corruption is a huge problem. All right. There's so much. I mean, really, John Boehner leaves politics and becomes a lobbyist for the marijuana industry. Really? Is this what government is meant to be? Is this what Madison figured? Did George Washington say, as soon as I am no longer the first president, I'm going to capitalize on my relationships and my connections? Friends, this is called corruption. We not only do it, we accept it, we regard it as normal, and the lobbying industry is just part of that, employing former lawmakers. So much so that there is so much cynicism that I was actually told by a lawmaker friend of mine that many people go into Congress with the explicit purpose of staying long enough to learn their way around, to get to know people, to get to know how all the bureaucracies work, and then to go out into the lobbying industry and make money. This is called corruption. Now, if you try that in Kenya or Nigeria or Ghana or Zambia, you'll get into trouble. They don't let you do that because they are trying to stamp out corruption. Do they still have corruption? Of course they do, but they're moving in the right direction. We're not! Tribalism. Back in the day, when I motorcycled through Africa, 1969 it was, and I was an official envoy of the African Road Federation. It's another story. But what I encountered were tribes, one tribe after another. And I'd come out of the territory of one tribe into the territory of another tribe. Everything was tribal. The huge genocide where a million Tutsis were massacred by the Hutus, those are not rotary clubs, my friends. Those are tribes. The Hutus is a tribe. The Tutsis are a tribe. And back in the day, Africa's huge problem was tribalism. Africa's huge problem was that the colonial powers, notably England, had carved borders without paying attention to tribal ownership. Okay, not a new story. And today you go to Africa, and people are for the most part dressed in Western dress, not all the time, not everybody, but no longer do they talk about what tribe you're in. If you ask, they'll tell you, but it's no longer of importance. People say, I'm a Ghanaian. They don't speak about which tribe. There were several tribes that lived in Ghana, and people still know their family and tribal connections, but they marry cross-tribally, and little by little, the tribes are becoming less and less important because Africa is moving from the third world towards the first world. You do not want tribalism in a first world society. But in the United States of America, tribalism is growing more and more. You have many different tribes here. You have women tribes. You have black tribe, the black people's tribe. You have the white people's tribe. You have the students' tribe. You have the trade unions' tribes. And many, many others that you can name as well. And they're all at war with one another, just the way it used to be in the third world. Third world, they used to hurl spears at one another. I started off telling you about this movie, Beyond Mombasa. And you'll see African tribes throwing spears at each other. Doesn't happen in Africa anymore, but it does happen in America. They're not throwing spears at each other. They're throwing barbs at each other. They are just as certainly trying to destroy one another. The attempts by several of the tribes to destroy Justice Kavanaugh and his tribe, well known. You have the tribe of people who will do anything necessary to promote abortion. Right, Planned Parenthood is part of the witch doctor and chief of that tribe. You got another tribe that's pro-life. America is full of tribes, and not only don't they talk to each other, they hate each other. That's exactly how it used to be in the old days in Africa. But Africa's moving away from tribalism. America is moving towards tribalism. Public hygiene. My friends, as I told you, in Africa, when I was a kid, Africa was a pretty filthy, smelly place. But it isn't anymore. Not like that anymore. Because public hygiene is taken very seriously. In America, politics, which is tribalism, is more important than public health. So the Center for Disease Control handles diseases all the way going back to AIDS, going to Ebola. All of these are handled from a political perspective because there are certain tribes you may not insult. The tribe of homosexuals is one of the tribes you may absolutely never insult. And so public hygiene down the tubes. Today in cities, and there are many cities like San Francisco, where you will find feces in the street, excrement in the street. You will find used syringes. You can even today, you may remember Starbucks brilliantly opened up their bathrooms to everybody. Well, good luck trying to find a Starbucks bathroom that you feel comfortable using these days, because in many cities, Starbucks bathrooms are now places where you will find blood-spattered syringes, drug paraphernalia, disgusting material all over the floor. There is no way. I always used to admire how Starbucks staff meticulously kept their bathrooms clean. Today, they can't do it anymore. It would require a commercial cleaning service to do the same thing. Why? Well, because there are tribes in America, and in order not to offend any tribes, public hygiene has been thrown out the window. Homeless, another one of the tribes, right? They're allowed to urinate in the street in public. Now, you better not try it because you'll get arrested. But that particular tribe has rights that you do not have. Another aspect of the third world, prosecutorial malice. Oliver Schmidt was an executive of Volkswagen, sentenced to 7 years in jail. Why? Because the company, and this is, again, it's a big, long story. I can't go into it at length here. Suffice it to say that the entire war on automobiles, the entire war on gasoline-driven automobiles has taken quite a lot of collateral damage. It has inflicted quite a lot of collateral damage. Bottom line is that it used to be that a corporation had a veil that shielded the people inside it. Now, you could impose huge fines, draconian fines. You could impose all kinds of sanctions against a corporation. You could even destroy a corporation. But it was understood that the people within the corporation were acting on behalf of the corporation. And so for that reason, and I know that the instinctive response to what I'm saying is, oh, this is terrible. Corporations let people get away with murder. Well, it's about time we prosecuted them. Look, when things go to excess in any direction, it's problematic. And be aware that this new trend of jailing corporate executives is going to come home to roost. It's going to hurt your ability to feed your family down the road, not far down the road, soon. Because one of the tribes in America that has almost unlimited power is the tribe of prosecutors, both state prosecutors and federal. The whole tribe of prosecutors are immensely powerful. And it really is up to them to what extent anybody is going to be persecuted and prosecuted. In many cases, many of them do a fine job. They're people of upright bearing who have a watchful eye out for crime. But unfortunately, that's not everybody. There are prosecutors, and I think everybody remembers the Duke LaCrosse case, where one of the prosecutors was finally, after a lot of outrage, was finally thrown out because he decided to placate the black tribe and prosecute members of the white tribe for no legal reasons, just because this was tribal warfare. And so this used to be a feature in Africa. Prosecutors were notorious. They were political agents. But today in Africa, there's been enormous awareness of the problem, and there has been enormous effort to return to normal rule of law. Africa moving in the right direction towards the first world. America progressing further down the dark road to the third world as a result of prosecutorial power and malice, and suppression of speech. Again, it used to be that in most of Africa, you couldn't talk freely. If you said anything that that insulted powerful figures, you were in very serious trouble. Well, that's no longer the case. Enormous effort has been made. As I alluded to, the Democratic Republic of the Congo having just recently had elections, and people who stood against the ruling force were very vocal. The Catholic Church is vocal. Today in the Congo, you can speak your mind. There is no suppression of speech as there used to be, certainly a lot less. But America is moving in the wrong direction. You may call it political correctness. You can call it whatever you like. But the direction we're moving in is the suppression of free speech, particularly in our institutional cultural memories, the tribe of education. In our tribe of educators, professors, bureaucrats, administrators, college presidents, in that world, suppression of speech is at third world levels. It really is. And so we're forced to end on a slightly sad note. Look, I'm optimistic. I think that in another, given a, you know, finish another half this term, given one more term, I'm somewhat hopeful that that the country is moving, at least it's not moving in the right direction yet. Make no mistake about it. We are moving in the direction of the third world. There's no mistake. But the speed is less. You know, when an airplane goes into a dive, that is a bad situation, right? Because it is heading towards a collision with the Earth. And so as it's descending and picking up speed, going faster and faster towards the Earth, that's worse and worse news. But if the skilled pilot is able to slow the rate of descent, the airplane is still dropping. It's still losing altitude, but not as fast as it was before. With each passing second, it's dropping fewer feet than it did the previous second. Well, if that trend continues, and it continues for long enough before the airplane hits the Earth, then it's going to reach a point where the airplane is flying horizontal, not going down any longer and not going up. And from there, it can start climbing again. I think that's where we're at. We're not at horizontal flight yet. We're still going down, but perhaps not quite as fast as we were before, maybe. Or maybe we are moving, hopefully, in a direction where the rate of descent is starting to slow down. Let's hope. But that we are still heading downwards, that we are still moving in the direction of the third world, whether it's water or transport or corruption or housing and shanty towns and the so-called homeless, the essence of tribalism, public hygiene, the power of the tribe of the prosecutors, the suppression of speech, and many other metrics of the third world. At the moment, we are moving downwards. We are moving in the direction of the third world. Doesn't have to be that way, and it didn't used to be that way. Until the 1960s, America was not only a proud first world nation, it was the leading first world nation. I pray that we do never become the leading third world nation. Please do visit the website, and go ahead and please go ahead and get yourself or somebody you care about a copy of Madam, I'm Adam, Decoding the Marriage Secrets from Eden. You can look up that product at rabbidaniellappin.com. That's our website, www.rabbidaniellappin.com. And go to the store section, read about Madam, I'm Adam, Decoding the Marriage Secrets from Eden. As I say, go ahead, invest in a copy. Make sure that you and your spouse, or you and your intended spouse, or you and somebody you'd like to be your spouse, listen to that together. And when you've done that, make sure other people in your orbit who need that information also get a chance to listen to that. I would appreciate that. And thank you very much indeed for doing so. The website again, rabbidaniellappin.com. It's also a place where you can read up the frequently asked questions, and it's also a place where you can communicate with me. Love hearing from you. Anything to ask me, tell me, say to me, go ahead and do that at rabbidaniellappin.com. Thanks so much for being part of the show. I appreciate you telling others about it, and I love watching the download figures climb, whether it's on iTunes or YouTube or SoundCloud or The Blaze or wherever you're listening. Be sure to let people know about it. I appreciate that very much indeed. I want to wish you for the coming week, a week of good times with your families, good times with your faith, good times with your friends, and good times with your romance and your finance. All important parts of life. I'm Rabbi Daniel Lappin. Thanks for listening. God bless.
Spilling ancient solutions to modern problems in areas of family, faith, friendship, and finance. This is Rabbi Daniel Lappin on demand on the Blaze Radio Network.